This is Professor Stephen J. Eagle at George Mason Law School, welcoming you to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group is hosting a debate on the issue of vehicle fuel emission standards. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. In remarks at the White House on January 26, President Obama declared that America's dependence on oil is one of the most serious threats that our nation has faced. It bankrolls dictators, pays for nuclear proliferation, and funds both sides of our struggle against terrorism. It puts the American people at the mercy of shifting gas prices, stifles innovation, and sets back our ability to compete. We must ensure that fuel-efficient cars of tomorrow are built right here in the United States of America. Increasing fuel efficiency of our cars and trucks is one of the most important steps we can take to break our cycle of dependence on foreign oil. It will also help spark the innovation needed to ensure that our auto industry keeps pace with competitors around the world. Thus spoke President Obama, who also indicated that the government would begin implementing new fuel economy standards for the model year 2011 to have cleaner, more efficient cars and trucks, which would not only be a down payment on a reduction of foreign oil, but also would help with the global greenhouse gas emissions situation, and there would also be stringent new emissions requirements. The increase in fuel economy standards, he said, would mean that we would have a fuel savings that would save most of the oil that we now import from many nations in the Middle East. The administration's proposals include tough standards for tailpipe emissions from new automobiles and would have the first national regulation for greenhouse gases. It's also embracing standards tough enough to satisfy California, which had been fighting for a waiver from federal laws so it could set its own emissions guidelines. And the EPA, using its power to regulate carbon dioxide emissions under a 2007 Supreme Court ruling, also plans to have tailpipe emission standards of 250 grams per mile for vehicles sold in 2016, roughly the equivalent of what would be emitted by vehicles meeting the mileage standards then expected to be in effect. So these are substantial new standards, and they produce both substantial costs and benefits to the American people. And today we have two experts eminently qualified to debate these emission standards. The first to speak will be James T.B. Tripp. Jim Tripp has served as counsel for Environmental Defense Fund since 1973 and has been general counsel since 1983. He's responsible for the review of all of Environmental Defense Fund's legal action initiatives. Through Environmental Defense Fund's Living Cities program, he works on a wide range of land use, transportation, water resources, solid waste, ecosystem restoration, and energy issues in the New York metropolitan region, and also has served on several New York State advisory boards. Mr. Tripp was Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York from 1968 through 73, and he has his Bachelor of Arts, Law degree, and Master's degree in Philosophy, all from Yale University. Our other debate panelist is Thomas Tanton. Tom Tanton is a senior fellow with the Pacific Research Institute, as well as the principal of T2 and Associates, a firm providing consulting services to the energy and technology industries. Mr. Tanton has over 35 years' experience in the energy, economy, and environmental fields. T2 and Associates are active in the area of energy and interconnected infrastructures, analyzing and providing advice on their impacts on energy prices, environmental quality, and regional environmental development. Tom Tanton previously served as Vice President and Senior Fellow with the Institute for Energy Research and General Manager for the Electric Power Research Institute. Prior to 2000, he was Principal Policy Advisor to the California Energy Commission. We're going to begin our program with Jim Tripp, who has been given a few extra minutes to lay out some of the specifics of the administration's proposals, after which he'll give his own views on the merits of the regulation that's being proposed. So we'll start then with Jim.
Thank you very much, Steve, for that introduction. As Steve mentioned, the two federal agencies that are most responsible for setting standards for motor vehicles, that is both passenger cars and light-duty trucks, the two agencies are the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Transportation. The proposal that they put forward appeared in the Federal Register on May 22nd this year. And the basic proposal Steve outlined is to reduce between now and model year 2016 carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, and also to improve fuel economy and to harmonize those two sets of standards. Now, what kind of a reduction are we talking about? Last year in 2008, 2007, 2008, the average new car had a fuel economy of about 25 miles per gallon. Under this proposal, by model year 2016, the average new car should have a fuel economy of about 35.5 miles per gallon and a comparable reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. That is about a 40% improvement from current levels. The EPA proposal also has some flexibility built in terms of banking of greenhouse gas emission credits, storing them up, trading them, and so on. It also proposes giving credit for improvements in air conditioning systems in motor vehicles and may provide some credit for low-carbon alternative fuels, such as, in certain cases, cars with electric motors. Now, all of this is done under existing federal law. EPA's authority comes from the Federal Clean Air Act that was adopted by the Congress in 1970. Since that time, EPA has from time to time adopted federal motor vehicle emission standards for nitrogen oxides, for particulates, and so on. As Steve mentioned, the Supreme Court in Massachusetts v. EPA a little bit more than 2 years ago made it clear that EPA has to set standards for carbon dioxide if it finds that carbon dioxide may endanger health and welfare. EPA has indicated through another proposal that it intends to make such an what we call an endangerment finding because of the long-term consequences of carbon dioxide emissions for global warming and, in turn, its impact on the U.S. economy and the environment. The U.S. Department of Transportation's authority comes under the Energy Policy and Conservation Act that was recently amended. And DOT sets fuel economy standards with the goal primarily of improving energy security. DOT has recently set some standards for 2009 through 11, and this proposal deals with model years 2012 through 16. Both EPA and the U.S. Department of Transportation in their various findings in their proposals have to make findings regarding technological and economic feasibility, safety, consumer choice, and adequate lead time. One can dispute those findings, but they are required under these laws, federal laws, to make those findings. California, as Steve also mentioned, California is the only state under our Federal Clean Air Act that is empowered to set its own motor vehicle emission standards. California adopted carbon dioxide emission standards for motor vehicles almost 5 years ago. They were challenged by the auto industry. But as part of this proposal, in effect, EPA and DOT and President Obama have taken the California carbon dioxide emission standards for model years 2012 through 16 and made them national. Well, one of the requests of the particularly the U.S. auto industry is that we have one set of national standards. In effect, they now have that through this action to take the California standards and make them national. Now, what is the underlying rationale for all this, and why do I support this proposal? Well, this proposal deals with, on the one hand, global warming, and on the other hand, energy security. Now, how significant is it? We have been pumping extra carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for almost 150 years, and carbon stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. It also stays in the ocean for a long period of time. So we're doing it against that legacy of 150 years of pumping extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But passenger motor vehicles are responsible for about 25% of U.S. total carbon dioxide emissions in any given year. And since the U.S. currently accounts for about 20% of global carbon dioxide emissions, that means our motor vehicle fleet is responsible for about 5% of current global CO2 emissions. Obviously, this has to be part of a broader national effort where there is a national carbon cap and trade program or whatever it is. But this is a start, and in my view, a significant start. Now, in terms of energy security, we import two-thirds to 70% of our oil. We know it now today costs about $70 a barrel. It has recently cost $100 a barrel. The oil that we consume in our motor vehicle fleet costs us, in terms of our trade deficit, about $200, $250 billion a year, a very large amount of money, and our trade deficit certainly has been a factor in our current economic malaise. So this proposal may eventually, as these new cars come into the fleet, reduce our oil imports somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion a year, depending on what the price of oil is. Will this proposal be good for the U.S. auto industry, the auto manufacturing industry? Yes. It should make the U.S. auto industry more competitive because it, in fact, will require U.S. companies to introduce new technologies and have them used across the fleet in a shorter lead time period than has been the case, and make the U.S. auto industry competitive with Japanese, European, and perhaps even Chinese auto manufacturing firms. So I believe that's one of the reasons they've embraced this proposal. We also have to recognize that the carbon dioxide from the U.S. motor vehicle fleet is not just a question of emission rates that this proposal deals with. There are other factors. One is the total amount of travel by both individuals and truckers. Another is the carbon emissions associated with fuel production. And another is congestion. In congested traffic, vehicles consume energy unless they have electric motors, and that produces no worthwhile economic outcome. We have to address all of these. But in my view, this is a start. We have to start somewhere, and EPA and DOT have existing legal authority to take this action. I applaud it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. On the question of, is this the right place to start, and do we have to start somewhere, different views from Tom Tanton.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk. The current proposal, in my view, is all pain and no gain. Jim has fairly characterized the number of features of the program. Unfortunately, the benefits claimed from the program are likely not to occur. And let's start with the issue of energy security. In the president's remarks back in January, he referred to the fact that we import a lot of oil, and we do. But there's a common fallacy that we import most of the imports come from the Middle East, when in fact more oil is imported from Canada and Mexico and from non-OPEC countries than from the Middle East. Furthermore, if we reduce our petroleum consumption, we're likely to force a reduction in domestic production rather than from those countries that pose a security risk. We will become, as a percentage, likely more dependent on those countries rather than less so, because the production domestically and in Canada and Mexico will be reduced because they are simply the more expensive forms of production. In addition, with increased fuel economy, drivers tend to drive more miles. It's referred to as the rebound effect. So much of the claimed benefit from increasing fuel efficiency disappears as drivers tend to drive more. More importantly, even if the rebound effect doesn't occur, the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that would result are so small as to not be a step at all. Jim referred to it being an important first step, but it's not a step at all. We need to keep in mind that anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, those man-made emissions, represent less than 5% of the total. And the U.S. represents less than 16% of the worldwide emissions. Even if we eliminate all of the U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases, the temperature out in 2050, using the official model of the IPCC, we have less than 0.5% change in temperature. We don't achieve anything, but we do know that safety is going to be probably compromised. We do know that it's going to cost consumers a lot. We do know that nobody has an idea as to what technologies are being forced. So the forecast, I mean, everybody sort of agrees that we're going to experience higher priced vehicles, but nobody knows what the technologies are. So estimating what that future cost might be is actually impossible, because they don't know what it is. How do they know what it's going to cost? The cost savings attributed to the increased efficiency is predicated on a forecast of future oil prices. Jim referred to the fact that today it's $70. You know, a little while back it was $100. A little while back it was also down to, you know, $52. So oil prices fluctuate, and forecasting a future cost savings in exchange for a today increased capital cost is simply securitizing based upon a forecast that has no relative certainty. Jim also mentioned that California is the only state in the nation that's allowed to set its own emission standards for vehicles, which is true. But as part of that, other states can embrace California's more stringent standards if they wish to. We end up in a situation where the president has agreed to embrace California standard, in essence, to avoid a situation of multiple model syndrome, where the, you know, car makers need to make multiple models of different cars to meet the different standards. But in the proposal itself, California still has the authority to go even further beyond what the president and EPA and Department of Transportation ultimately decide on. So the fundamental issue of harmony between the states and the federal government is not being satisfied. It's just a bad idea. It's not going to make U.S. automakers more competitive versus foreign makers of automobiles, because those foreign makers of automobiles, in order to capture part of the American market, will have to embrace those same, as yet unknown, technologies. So there's no competitive advantage for U.S. automakers. I think it's interesting to note that the typical cycle of designing and manufacturing new vehicles is about 4 or 5 years. I mean, it takes that long to design and change your equipment in the factory and all that sort of stuff. Today, if the 2016 standards were in effect, only four cars, model cars, would meet that standard. I don't think the lead time is enough. It's forcing technologies that are unknown. It does a de minimis amount with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, and it does absolutely nothing and likely negative with respect to oil security.
Thank you, Tom Tanton. Each of our debaters now has 3 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll start with Jim Tripp.
It is true, as with any investment, very often the pain precedes the gain, but the long-term gain from this proposal and similar proposals in the future to address carbon dioxide emissions will be very significant. Prior, 120, 150 years ago, carbon dioxide emission concentrations in the atmosphere were about 260 million parts per million. They're now 360. That increase is totally due to anthropogenic carbon emissions over that period of time. And the question in terms of global warming is how much further that is going to go up and how much higher it will go up before things like the collapse of ice sheets will occur. But the fact is that the carbon dioxide coming from the U.S. motor vehicle fleet is significant. It's significant nationally, and it's significant globally. Will it take time to have an effect on carbon dioxide emissions? Yes, because today's emissions are going into an atmosphere that has been impacted by 150 years of carbon emissions. In terms of oil security, if you look at where the long-term reserves of oil are, they're not in Mexico. They are in the Middle East, Russia, and possibly Venezuela. Those are where the big reserves are. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about where oil is going to come from the next handful of years, but 10, 20, or 30 years down the road. Do oil prices fluctuate? But increasingly, the price of oil is being determined by demand from China and India. The U.S., up until 10 years ago, is the primary determinant of the price of oil by our own demand for it, but that is radically changing. And that's why what Tom referred to as the rebound effect is really no effect at all. If you look at auto sales in China and India, the demand for oil is going to go up, and the price of oil in all likelihood will go up. Tom said no one knows what the technologies are. U.S. EPA and the Department of Transportation know what the technologies are through model year 2016. Do we know what they're going to be in 2020, 2030, 2050? No, but we certainly know what they're going to be through 2016. That's how EPA and DOT can make determinations that this proposal is technologically and economically feasible. Tom is also right that under the president's proposal, California will have the authority to go further after model year 2016. But the federal government will also have an opportunity then to decide whether or not to adopt the California program so that we retain a national program.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Tom, a response?
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, I agree that atmospheric concentrations of CO2 have been increasing, and they have been for much longer than Jim has referred to, but let's take a look at the last 10 or 15 years. Actually, the climate has been cooling over the last 10 or 15 years. The Antarctic ice shelf has been growing in ice mass, so I'm not sure the urgency of acting is here. With respect to oil reserves, I completely agree that we need to take a long-term view and look at proven reserves. The U.S. itself has proven reserves if we were able to develop them. ANWR itself could satisfy perhaps 30 or 40 years of our entire oil imports. The problem is that oil imports from non-secure areas or anywhere else, for that matter, has been cast as a false choice of eliminating oil use or importing it from those foreign despots. That's not the choice, the only choice that we have. We can develop our own proven reserves as well. And just, you know, last week, major finds off the coast of Brazil were announced, and they, in fact, are receiving federal support from the U.S. government to develop those. We should be spending that money here to develop our own resources. There's a lot of technologies that are on the horizon that may or may not address the issue. And a catalog of technologies early on for major regulatory activities is putting the cart before the horse, in my view. Those technologies, while they've been identified, have not been proven. We don't know how they're going to be accepted by the marketplace. We don't know what it's going to do to other features of driving a vehicle. I've spent 35 years in the California market, and California has frequently forced technologies into the market that later on are found to be unacceptable for any number of reasons. Our electric vehicle mandate is identical in many respects regulatorily with the new president's proposal for higher mileage vehicles, but it had to be abandoned when it was shown not to work and simply unacceptable.
Okay, thank you very much, Tom Tanton. I have a question for both panelists, and perhaps Jim Tripp could begin. The energy market, especially petroleum, is quintessentially a unified world market with a world price and flows in all directions. If one nation starts buying oil from another, then as opposed to a third, then that supply from the third country will go somewhere else and so on. And also, global warming is uniquely a world problem. Any CO2 introduced anywhere in the world affects everyone, and correspondingly, countries at home are relatively little affected by what they do. Does the fact that both of these are truly global problems cut for or against nations unilaterally trying to adopt solutions? Any thoughts on this? First, Jim Tripp.
Well, with respect to global warming, yes, clearly it's a global problem, but as I indicated, the United States emits somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. It was a few years ago 25% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. So even if we're going to have a global program to deal with, and we should, and there are international negotiations going on now to try and come up with some kind of a international program, the U.S. has got a very, very important role to play in that. And the question is whether we're going to be prepared, whether we want to do it, whether we're going to be prepared to do it. And this proposal, in my view, indicates that we're serious about it. And I think the ability of the United States to influence what other countries in the world do will be greatly enhanced if we're taking some serious action ourselves that the rest of the world can see and can respect. In terms of energy markets, so let me just say in summary in that point that the fact that the Obama administration has put forward this proposal under U.S. law for motor vehicle fuel economy standards and carbon dioxide emission standards is not at all inconsistent with a national and global strategy. In fact, it's entirely consistent with it. In terms of energy markets, yes, there is a world oil price, but the international oil market is a somewhat manipulated market. A very large portion of the reserves are held by OPEC countries. If more oil is to be pumped, it's going to come from Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Iran. It's not going to come from Mexico. And that price is increasingly determined not just on the supply side by OPEC, but on the demand side by what's happening in rapidly growing countries, particularly those in Asia such as China and India. And boy, if you go to China and see the number of vehicles that are in use there today compared to just 5 years ago and what the projections are for the auto industry there, and do the same thing in India and Indonesia, these are countries with very large populations, or the same thing even in Brazil. You can see where the demand for oil is going to come from, and there's no indication that the worldwide supply of oil is going to grow all that fast. So there are sound reasons, national reasons, for the U.S. to reduce its total oil consumption, and indeed that would allow developing countries to have more of it.
Okay, thank you. Tom Tanton, what do you think on this?
Well, I think we're looking at the picture a little wrong. I agree that a global solution or a global problem requires a global solution. Unfortunately, this is not it. We need to keep in mind that even though the U.S. emits, 18 or 20% of the global greenhouse gas emissions, that's largely because we produce over 30% of the world's gross domestic product. We are more efficient at using fuel. We are more efficient at using capital. We're more efficient at using labor than anywhere else in the country, or excuse me, in the world. That's why we've become the wealthiest nation on earth, because we're more efficient. Our productivity index is so much better. We're on a 20-year continuing improvement in carbon intensity, i.e. the measurement of how many tons of carbon per dollar GDP, than anywhere else. 20 years of continuing improvement. What we need to do as a global solution is have other countries follow our technological lead, our efficiency lead, our productivity lead, not to reduce ourselves to their level by decreasing productivity, using the most expensive forms of everything, and, simply reallocating capital, wealth, and labor. If we show the rest of the world that carbon intensity can continue to be reduced through technological improvements and innovation spurred by free market, that is the global solution we need, not one where we bring ourselves down to their level.
Thanks. Jim Tripp, is it possible that this solution that's being proffered is being proffered only because it's politically palatable, and that really it's a kind of convoluted second-best idea, a Rube Goldberg kind of complex machine to do something that could be done much simpler by simply having a carbon tax and a BTU tax and a tax on emissions?
A carbon tax, or more specifically, a tax on transportation fuels, particularly oil-based fuels, would certainly be effective at encouraging American consumers to purchase more fuel-efficient vehicles that would also have lower carbon dioxide emissions. It would promote alternative fuel technologies. It would discourage oil imports and so on. Personally, I think such a proposal is totally consistent with what President Obama is proposing in terms of mandating improved fuel economy standards and reducing carbon dioxide emissions for motor vehicles. It's consistent with it because it gives a pricing signal that people should prefer the kinds of vehicles that have better fuel economy and lower carbon dioxide emission standards. It would, in effect, raise the price of gasoline the way all gasoline taxes do. So I personally support it. People who know a lot more about national politics than I do say that the likelihood that that is going to happen is very small. But I personally hope that we will see a significant increase in federal and state gasoline taxes for that matter. But I don't think it would be a substitute for this. I think it would reinforce it. I think the two would go together. Unless and until we have that kind of a motor vehicle fuel tax increase in steady steps, this is the proposal that's on the table. If someone comes forward and says we could increase federal gasoline taxes 25 cents a year for the next 10 years or 50 cents a gallon for the next 10 years, that would do a whole lot of good, and I would applaud it, but I just don't see it on the table right now.
Thank you. Tom Tandon, assuming that you were forced to prefer one or the other, a carbon tax or a kind of command and control mechanism embodied in President Obama's scheme, which would you think would be better?
Well, frequently testifying as an expert witness, I always hesitate to answer a hypothetical, but if I were forced at gunpoint to choose between a carbon tax and a command and control type approach or even cap and trade, I would choose carbon tax. But keep in mind that a carbon tax is similarly Goldberg-esque in its complexity. At what point do you impose a tax? Do you impose it on the end user or do you impose it on the producer? What about taxes on things like ethanol? Do I have to pay through my tax for the destroyed rainforest in the Amazon where they're clear-cutting it to grow, you know, feed for fuel? So that it sounds like a nice, simple solution, and on its face it is, but there's a lot of complexities to it that open up problems with respect to political machinations and mistakes. I'll use the example here in California. We've got a low-carbon fuel standard. The poster child for the low-carbon fuel standard had been ethanol until more recent information showed that, well, wait a minute, maybe it's not such a good idea because on a life cycle basis, it ends up producing more carbon dioxide. And then what do you do with the revenues that collected through this carbon tax? So the problem with the carbon tax is it is a better choice, but it's still a negative choice. It's just not as negative as most of the other mechanisms.
Yeah.
Can I make one additional comment?
Jim? Sure, Jim Tripp.
We're talking about two, and I'm not an economist, but we're talking about two different kinds of externalities here. One externality is pumping more carbon into the atmosphere with the consequences that the International Panel on Climate Change has indicated are likely to occur. Right now, the emission discharge of carbon into the atmosphere is free, just the way all air pollution was basically free prior to 1970, and therefore very few people were doing anything about it. The other externality is our current account deficit. Unfortunately, or unfortunately because of the recession, has come down a great deal. But our current account deficit a year ago was around $800 billion a year. And in effect, China, Japan, Indonesia, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, countries with huge trade surpluses with the United States, have been willing to re-export those dollars and not invest in U.S. factories or manufacturing capability, but to buy U.S. government bonds. Now, that, in effect, in my view, is an externality, because we don't know what the long-term consequences of that are going to be, but I think the recession is in part a result of that. So the question is, are we going to deal with those externalities? If we're going to do it, we need regulation in a way to market solutions. There are two basic tools for internalizing these costs. One is a carbon cap and trade system with carbon limits set at really the production or importation level, and let the market sort it out from there, something that my organization, the Environmental Defense Fund, strongly endorses. The other would be a carbon tax should be designed to reflect these external costs associated with pumping carbon into the atmosphere.
Tom Tandon, any response to that?
Yes. I agree that there are externalities involved. but would point out that not all externalities are necessarily negative. There are also benefits in both the security arena as well as the climate change arena. The second and more important thing, and these are referred to as Pigouvian taxes, the more important aspect is correctly calculating what the value of that external cost is. Too frequently, analysts and policymakers and policy wonks will calculate that based on the cost of control. What does it cost to remove a ton of carbon from the emission stream? That is incorrect, and it's a fallacy. The only correct way to calculate that cost or benefit is through what is referred to as damage function analysis. What is the actual damage and the avoided value of that damage by imposition of the tax? Unless that calculation is done, it is likely that a number of negative consequences result. And then the third question is, what do you do with the revenue collected through that tax? And, you know, that opens up a whole other political problem. When we might think back a few years to the administration of Bill Clinton, where a carbon tax was discussed, and it was thoroughly and roundly thrown out.
Hey, Tom, let me ask you a question. Whether one believes in global warming caused by people and having destructive effects or not, and I know there are some who vociferously don't agree with that, there does seem to be a movement generally in the world arguing for restructuring of world trade and taxation based on that theory. Is the United States in danger of having other countries reach a consensus where we'll be at a disadvantage unless we take the lead, both in terms of setting a good example and also helping to organize a response?
Well, I think we're certainly at a risk. But let me respond to, I mean, we're at risk now. Even taking the lead, China and India say it basically sent us trillion-dollar checks, and then we'll talk. Well, that's no solution at all. So we don't avoid that risk by embracing a particular thing. We need to keep in mind that which we're usually taught in CEO school. There's two parts here. One is to do the right thing, and one is to do the thing right. Our discussion today has been about doing the thing right. Acquiescing to the demands of China and India is not doing the thing right. Acquiescing to command and control is not doing the thing right. And imposing carbon tax or other command and control or cap and trade is not doing the thing right. I'm not here to argue for or against doing something about climate change. But if we're going to do something, and it seems to be that's where the momentum is heading, let's make sure we do it right. We don't fail. If we fail and our economy further tanks, what's the rest of the world going to do? They're going to say that lead is not a good lead to follow.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. My last question goes to Jim Tripp, and this question is based on the old Roadrunner cartoon. You recall the Roadrunner swerves at the last second, leaving Wile E. Coyote to run off the cliff, and he keeps running at full speed until he looks down, discovers there is no solid earth under him, and then he falls like a stone. Similarly, I have the impression that you're suggesting that one day the world is going to run out of cheaper available energy, and at that point suddenly we're going to be literally over a barrel and we're going to be at a grave disadvantage. Is that the case, or is it more likely that as energy supplies decrease and prices go up, the market will take that as a signal to come up with some innovative changes, such as oil shale production or new kinds of technology or nuclear fuel or other kinds of innovations?
Well, the market can do a whole lot. We saw what the market did when the price of gasoline went up to over $4 a gallon a year and a half ago. And there was a dramatic response really before the beginning of our current recession in terms of the kinds of motor vehicles that people wanted to buy and the willingness of automobile manufacturers to invest and implement advanced technologies. So one of the ways in which industry and the U.S. consumer is going to respond to what you were talking about, market demand, is through the introduction and consumer demand for more efficient energy technologies. That's going on now, and in my view, this proposal will, you know, help drive that. But underlying this proposal are the very kinds of market forces that you're talking about. Regulation alone is not going to drive the kind of change that we need. Energy in all of our sectors can be used much more efficiently, and there are alternative forms of energy that can, that have far less carbon associated with them than oil or coal, for that matter. So I am not an advocate for, you know, command and control. I don't see a carbon cap and trade system that way, a tax system that way. I think there's all kinds of ways to encourage technological innovation.
Okay, thank you, Jim. This is Stephen Eagle at George Mason Law School. First, thanking James T.B. Tripp of the Environmental Defense Fund and Thomas Tanton of the Pacific Research Institute for your very interesting and stimulating presentations and exchanges of views. And also, thank you, the listener. We hope that you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you again for listening.